So we quantify this condition with a parameter called the slow roll parameter, which we term epsilon, which is just the thing that has to be small, defined with these conventional factors. So this just has to be much less than 1, is exactly the criteria that the kinetic term is subdominant to the potential term in the Friedmann equation. And using the Friedmann equation, we can also write this as minus h dot over h. This is sometimes h squared. This is sometimes more convenient to use. So this is the epsilon slow roll parameter. The other criteria we want is to ensure that this state of affairs of the domination of the potential over the kinetic term lasts for a sufficiently long time so that we get enough inflation. So we need the scalar field to be slowly changing over the time scale that the universe is evolving. So that requirement is this, that the second derivative is much smaller than Hubble constant times the first derivative. So you can think of this as the rate of change of the derivative of the field in one Hubble time. We want the so we don't want the field to be speeding up over the course of one Hubble time. Okay, so once this is ensured, it means this part of this equation is small and can be ignored. So that means this part that's left is going to be comparable to this part here. So this is comparable to V prime. So the second slow roll parameter, we call it eta, is just this quantity that has to be small, phi double dot over h phi dot. So slow roll inflation happens when both epsilon and eta are less than 1. Okay, so the equations of motion under this approximation, we simply drop this kinetic term and we drop this kinetic term. So the slow roll equations of motion are simply these. Okay, so these are our true conditions for slow roll. It's sometimes useful to recast these small parameters in terms of the potential alone. So these will be called the potential slow roll parameters. So we're just going to use these equations to manipulate these into things that depend only on the potential. So let me call this equation 1. Let me call this equation 2. If I take equation 1 squared divided by equation 2 squared, I can write this as h squared phi dot squared 1 to the 4th h to the 4th. And then I can write this now completely in terms of the potential. And this quantity here is nothing but epsilon times m Planck squared. So we can define what we call the potential slow roll parameter, which is nothing but epsilon written in terms of the potential. And we define that as this. Okay, so this gives you a criteria solely in terms of a potential for whether this is small. Okay, we can do the same thing with eta. Let's take the time derivative of equation 2. I can write that as 3h dot phi dot 3h phi double dot equals v double prime phi dot. That's just the time derivative of this. This can be written as just dividing through by h squared. Okay, and now these are our, we can relate in terms of our slow roll parameters over there. So I'll write this as minus h dot, I'll just divide through by 3. And now these expressions are just our slow roll parameters epsilon and eta. So we'll define our eta, our potential slow roll parameter, which is, this is epsilon, this is eta, and on this side we have something that depends only on the potential, which also has to be small. So we have these now, these two criteria in terms of the potential. So now given any potential, if someone hands you a potential, you can just check, are these quantities small? If so, your potential can support slow roll inflation, and if not, your potential can't support slow roll inflation. If you're given a potential which satisfies these criteria, it's a necessary but not sufficient condition that they be small in order to have inflation, because it's always possible that you can have a potential which satisfies this, but you take the field and you start it with an initial velocity that's very large and you just throw it down the hill and you won't have slow roll. So you've, by doing this manipulation to get things in terms of the potential, we've lost the requirement that the initial velocity of the field be small. So given a potential that satisfies these, it's always possible for it to be slow roll, but you still have to ensure that the initial velocity of the field will be small. Okay, so now we can give a criteria for the number of e-folds of inflation that happens during slow roll over an excursion, during an excursion across some potential. So our expression for the number of e-folds, n, was this integral from the start of inflation to the time when inflation ends of the Hubble constant during inflation. So now I'll just use the chain rule to write this in terms of the field. So an integral over the field value that it starts at to the field value that it ends at. And now we'll use the slow roll equations. To write this in terms of the potential. Like so. Okay, so given any potential, you can calculate how many e-folds of inflation it can support by just doing this integral between the field values that you want inflation to start and end at. Okay, so let's do an example of a potential. So this potential is one of the sort of benchmark models for inflation, where you take a simple phi squared potential, just a free scalar. At least there's no self-interactions for the scalar. It still interacts with gravity. So this is sometimes goes by the name of chaotic inflation for other reasons. And it's sort of considered like the simplest benchmark version of inflation. So whenever new data comes in, you typically like to compare it against this model just to see where it stands. Okay, so given this potential, we can calculate the slow roll, the potential slow roll parameters. Okay, so for these for this potential, both the epsilon and the eta happen to be the same. It's just the size of the field relative to the Planck scale. So to have slow roll in this model, we need both of these to be small, so we need phi to be much larger than the Planck mass. So this is what is often termed a large field inflation model. Because the value of the field itself is much larger than the Planck mass. So it makes some people worry about whether you can actually trust this model because you're having to deal with field values that are much larger than the Planck mass, which is the scale of quantum gravity. But nevertheless, the energy density in the field does not have to be much larger than the Planck energy density. So if we calculate the energy density, it just goes like m squared phi squared. And if we demand that this be much less than m Planck squared, this gives us m Planck to the fourth, which is the Planck density. This gives us a condition on the field that phi should be much less than m Planck squared over m. Okay, so we have a window here. If phi is much larger than m Planck, but much less than m Planck squared over m, we will both have slow roll inflation and energy density much less than the Planck energy density. Okay, so let's calculate the number of e-folds of inflation over some excursion in field space. So we'll use that formula from over there. V over V prime. And we just plug in V and do the integral. And we get this expression. So just as an illustration, let's imagine that that we're sort of going to scan a range that's sort of two orders of magnitude here. So let's imagine that phi initial. So for example, let's take phi initial to be 10 times m Planck, so that we're well within this range here, and then phi final to be 1/10 times m Planck squared over m. So we're just sort of scanning over something that stays within one order of magnitude of these endpoints. If we plug these values in, and let's say that we demand the typical 60 e-folds of inflation. So let's set this six equal to 60, and then plug in these values for phi initial and phi final. We can then use this to solve for the ratio m Planck over m. And this tells us that m Planck over m has to be roughly 50 or so. So it tells us that the scalar field mass has to be much less than the Planck mass. Okay, so the mass here has to be much less than the Planck mass. So this is sometimes termed the eta problem. And it's essentially a mini hierarchy problem. The fact that you have a scalar field which has a mass much less than the putative cutoff of your theory. It's the same kind of naturalness problem that you have in the standard model, that the Higgs mass is much less than the scale of quantum gravity. And this, it's called the eta problem because if you look at what the eta slow roll parameter was, eta was m Planck squared times v double prime over v. And if you're talking about a potential, if you're at some point in a potential, vw prime over v is essentially like the mass of a particle that would be described at the minimum of that potential. So the requirement that eta is small is precisely the requirement that this mass is much less than the mass of the Planck, than the Planck mass. So you're, in order to have slow roll happen at all, you have to have this kind of hierarchy. Okay, so any questions on inflation before we move on? Yes.
Can you explain again how you got the numerical values for n? Like, why is it 60?
So 60 is sort of the fiducial value that people like to have enough inflation to solve these cosmological problems that we mentioned, the monopole and the flatness and the horizon problem. If you go through and ask how much inflation do you need to sort of safely solve all those problems, 60 is sort of a typical value that comes out. Okay. All right, so now we're going to go on and start talking about fluctuations and how to calculate the fluctuations that are generated during inflation, which eventually get related to the CMB fluctuations that are seen in the sky. Okay, so we're going to start with a toy version of these fluctuations. So in reality, the universe is filled with all the various fluids, all the plasma at early times, the dark matter, gravity, all of these different components. There's some background solution that describes their evolution. There's fluctuations on top of those background solutions, and you have to, in reality, track the fluctuations of all of these fields, solve them all simultaneously, and figure out how they evolved. But what I want to start with is just a toy model for the fluctuations, which is just a massless scalar living on top of the FRW background. So this will be sort of a toy model for the real fluctuations, which we'll do for inflation later on. Okay, so here's our massless scalar. So this is not the inflaton or anything. This is just a toy scalar that we're going to use to learn about how fluctuations evolve and behave on an FRW background. Okay, so let's evaluate this on our FRW background. So the metric, again, is our standard flat FRW with some scale factor. So too, we also need the inverse metric, which is just 1 over a squared. And we'll also need the metric determinant here, which is just a cubed. Okay, so plugging all these in here and evaluating, this becomes, I'll write it as separating out space and time, 1/2 a cubed, this is from the determinant, phi dot squared minus 1 over a squared, gradient phi squared. Okay, so this kind of structure is common. Spatial derivatives generally come with a 1 over a squared because it's spatial lengths are expanding with a squared, and time derivatives don't come with anything, and you have these a factors out front coming from the determinant. Okay, so let's look at the equations of motion. You get phi double dot plus 3h phi dot minus 1 over a squared grad squared phi equals 0. So this part here is the same as what we had for inflation. That's the homogeneous case, but without the potential. And now we're keeping track of the spatial variation as well. So this 3h factor comes from when you take the equations of motion here, you have to integrate by parts, and the time derivative here is going to hit the a out front. Okay. Okay, so the thing to notice is that once we go to Fourier space, so let's write this in Fourier space. So we define a Fourier field where we Fourier transform only with respect to the spatial coordinates. And when we plug this into the equation, it just changes the spatial derivatives to k's. Okay, so the thing to notice here is that this is the equation of motion for a damped harmonic oscillator. So this term here looks like the frequency omega squared of some harmonic oscillator. And this term here, proportional to the first derivative, looks like a damping factor for the harmonic oscillator that causes the oscillations to damp out in time. So this is often called Hubble friction, because you can really think of it as like friction. If you have, you can think of this as like some potential with a curvature set by this k, and the field is oscillating in here, but there's going to be some friction due to this term here, which causes the oscillations to decrease in amplitude. Okay, so there's two different regimes that a damped harmonic oscillator can be in, depending on whether the frequency here is much larger than the damping, or the damping is much larger than the frequency. So if you remember from classical mechanics, you talk about underdamped and overdamped harmonic oscillators. So the underdamped case is the case where this term here essentially dominates over that term there. So the condition is that H is much less than K times A, or K over A. And in this case, it behaves more or less like an ordinary harmonic oscillator because the damping is very small. So in this case, the mode oscillates with a frequency set by this k over a. The other extreme is the case where it's overdamped. And in this case, H is much larger than K over A. And in this case, if it's severely damped, essentially there's a whole lot of friction. The mode just sits here and can't really move at all. It's just sort of stuck on the hill, or maybe it moves a tiny little bit. But in the extreme case where H is much larger than K over A, it's literally just stuck and frozen here on the potential. So we say that the mode is frozen. Okay, so this the comparison here is whether h times a is bigger than or less than the mode number k. This quantity h times a is called the co-moving horizon. And often cosmologists just call it the horizon. It's not necessarily equal to the horizon that we talked about before. So if we had this picture of the FRW space in conformal time and the Big Bang, and we talked about the maximum distance that you could have traveled since the Big Bang. This horizon is different from this horizon. This horizon is called the particle horizon. And it depends on the whole history of the universe because it talks about how much time you could have traveled since the Big Bang. This horizon is just a measure of the physical size of the Hubble constant at some time. So it's not necessarily related to the causal horizon at any time, but it's what determines whether these modes are damped or not damped. So we're going to talk about modes inside the horizon or modes outside the horizon, and it's this horizon, this co-moving horizon that we talk about. Okay, so if we have a mode which is much less than, or much greater than this co-moving horizon, we say that the mode is inside the horizon. So it means that the wave number is much larger than the physical value of the Hubble constant at that time, which means that the mode is it essentially looks like it doesn't really notice the cosmology. It's sort of well within the scale, it's vibrating on a scale faster than the evolution of the universe at that time. The other extreme, k much less than ha, we say that the mode is outside the horizon. And in this case, the wavelength of the mode is much larger than the Hubble size, and the mode doesn't really move at all. It's sort of stuck and frozen. So in this case, we say that the mode is conserved outside the horizon because it's frozen on the potential. It doesn't really move. Its value doesn't change much in time. Okay, so this quantity h times a that we called the horizon, it's also precisely the quantity that's either decreasing or increasing depending on whether we have inflation or not. So you recall that the condition we had for inflation was that a double dot is greater than zero. And you can write that also as d by dt of ha. D by dt of ha is nothing but a double dot. So during inflation, the time derivative of ha is greater than zero. So ha, the horizon, is increasing. Whereas during non-inflation, it's decreasing. Okay, so the behavior of this horizon in relation to the modes is different depending on whether you're in an inflationary phase or in a normal FRW phase. So let's talk about the non-inflating case first. So for non-inflating universe, we have d by dt of h of a is less than zero. In other words, the size of the co-moving horizon is decreasing. So let me draw a plot here of the size of the we're going to plot time increasing on the horizontal axis, and on the vertical axis is going to be scale. So we've got a universe where h times a is decreasing. So I'll draw h times a as some decreasing curve here, h times a. So now let's focus on a mode of with some value of k. So there's some value of k that your mode has. Let's say it's this value here. So to start with, this mode has a k which is less than this h times a. So it starts by being outside the horizon. And eventually, because h a is decreasing, the mode crosses and it enters the horizon. So here it's outside, here it's inside. So if we draw the corresponding plot of what's happening to the value of the field itself as a function of time, so here's the value of the field, it starts by being outside of the horizon. So it starts by being more or less frozen on its quadratic potential. It's unable to move because of the Hubble friction. But as soon as this friction term drops and the mode goes inside the horizon, it's now no longer stuck, and it becomes a underdamped oscillator, and it starts to oscillate like so. Okay, so we'll see in a minute that these wiggles here, this is what you're seeing in the cosmic microwave background. It's this effect of different modes entering the horizon at different times which are responsible for those peaks and wiggles that you see. Okay, so here's how to see that. So let me just draw this plot here a little bit bigger because we want to put in a bunch of different modes. So here's the co-moving horizon. Just as an example, you can imagine the radiation-dominated phase. Where A goes like T to the 1/2. Hubble constant goes like 1 over T. So the co-moving horizon, H times A, is going like T to the minus 1/2. So this curve is supposed to be T to the minus 1/2. So we have scale here, time here, and HA is decreasing. Okay, so let's say that this is the start of the radiation domination era here, the Big Bang. And let's say that here is the time of recombination. Okay, so here's where the CMB forms and starts to free stream. Previous to this, there's some plasma. So you can think of this scalar field is like the density of the plasma. And these oscillations are like oscillations in the density of the plasma. They're called acoustic oscillations. Okay, so let's start by imagining a mode that has a very large wave number, k. So here, it starts life outside the horizon. It enters the horizon, and then it starts wiggling. And it wiggles many, many, many times before it hits the point where the CMB forms and then imprints on the CMB and free streams to where we are. So what we're seeing in the CMB is essentially the value of the mode at this time of recombination. So this very high K mode would correspond to a very high L mode in the CMB. Okay, so let's look at a mode with slightly lower K here. So here it enters the horizon later, and it wiggles, and it has a lower frequency when it starts wiggling, so it wiggles slower until it eventually hits the CMB. Okay. And as you get lower still, you find a mode which enters the horizon fairly late and has time to only wiggle one time before it hits the CMB. So it hits the CMB. The mode always starts at its maximum because it's essentially stuck on this potential. It's stuck here outside the horizon, and then as soon as the horizon becomes small enough, it sort of is released and falls down. So it's essentially starts in a cosine mode. It always starts in its maximum and then falls down. So this mode here is going to, that has the right frequency here, is going to start at its maximum and do one oscillation before it hits the CMB. So it will hit here when it's at its maximum. And we'll see this as a peak in the CMB spectrum. Another mode here will come and will not have time to do even one oscillation. It'll only have time to do a half oscillation. So it'll hit here at its minimum. And we'll see that as a minimum in the CMB spectrum. Okay, so if we look at this plot of the power spectrum of the CMB versus L, we had these peaks and troughs. So this first peak here corresponds to the mode that had time to oscillate exactly once before imprinting on the CMB. And the first trough was the mode that didn't have time. It reaches its minimum when it imprints on the CMB. So if you want, you can even calculate for yourself on Mathematica using this toy model a CMB spectrum like this. You would just solve this differential equation for various values of an initial k, start them all off at a time where they're all well outside the horizon, and you have to assign what are the initial values that they started with outside the horizon. The initial values are what we're going to calculate from inflation. That's the input to all of this. These initial values are drawn from some spectrum of initial fluctuations. So you can make up a distribution of initial values. You can then just solve the differential equation, run it, watch them oscillate, take the value at some time of recombination, and plot what that value looks like. You can even project it onto a sphere if you want to see, turn it into spherical harmonics, and you should get a plot that roughly looks like this. Okay, so this is what's happening after inflation. So this statement that the modes all formed outside the horizon and then entered, it's known as adiabatic modes. Adiabatic, they didn't change very much. And it's a remarkable fact about the universe that a single adiabatic mode accounts for all the fluctuations that are seen in the CMB. It didn't have to be that way. So there are many, many different fluid components in the universe. There's all the dark matter, there's all the plasma, there's the gravity. All of these different components, they could all have had different initial conditions and different, you in general think that you need as many initial conditions as there are fields, as many modes as there are fields. But in fact, there's only one scalar mode that you need to worry about, called this adiabatic mode. This one set of initial conditions that you have to specify, which starts outside the horizon and then enters. So that scalar mode, you can think of it as like an overall density or something. Like the initial plasma, its overall density has these fluctuations. That's why they're called acoustic oscillations, because they're sort of fluctuations in the overall density of the plasma. But there are no fluctuations in the relative densities between the various different components. Those are sometimes called isocurvature modes. So the fact that the modes are all within the overall density and not within any sort of relative density is one of the evidences that people cite for inflation, because inflation predicts that this is what will happen. So there were competing theories back in the day about what would be responsible for generating these perturbations. For example, people thought that cosmic strings would be responsible for this, that there'd be some network of cosmic strings which is moving around and wiggling and generating these perturbations. And the cosmic string spectrum would be kind of, if you had cosmic strings wiggling around in the early universe, you'd be constantly generating these modes. You wouldn't be starting off with this clean outside the horizon and then entering. You'd be sort of constantly generating new modes. So you wouldn't get this sort of coherent structure of peaks that you get in the CMB. You would get just sort of an incoherent mess. So the fact that you have, that you see this peak structure and that it's has this beautiful coherence is a sign that these modes all sort of started cleanly outside the horizon and then entered and were oscillating in this coherent fashion that, that could then imprint on the CMB. Okay, so now let's study what happens. So this is over there is the picture of what happens in an in the universe that's not inflating in the standard radiation dominated phase. Let's now talk about what happens during inflation. So now we have that the rate of change of the co-moving horizon is greater than zero. So now if we plot what's happening as a function of time, the co-moving horizon is increasing, like so. So for example, during slow roll inflation, the scale factor is going exponentially, which means that A times H is also growing exponentially. So this is like an exponentially growing curve that I have to draw here for the co-moving horizon. So now if I look at a particular mode K, it starts well inside the horizon. And as time progresses, it eventually exits the horizon. So if I draw the corresponding picture of the value of the field, phi, it starts being very wiggly and able to oscillate. And then eventually, when it passes outside the horizon, it freezes at some value, at whatever value it had as it was crossing the horizon. OK, so the statement is that during inflation, modes that are present all eventually leave the horizon and freeze. The idea is that these initial modes are generated quantum mechanically. So what we're going to do is calculate what the sort of average amplitude of the mode is expected to be here quantum mechanically. And then you say that it freezes. And that gives the value then of the mode that re-enters the horizon once inflation is done. So here's sort of a complete picture of inflation plus radiation domination. So I'll draw this bigger picture. It's a function of time. So we're going to say that the universe started in an inflationary phase. It later transitions into the ordinary radiation domination phase. So during inflation, this co-moving horizon, A times H, was increasing. During radiation domination, we saw that it's decreasing. So we don't know very much about what happened between inflation and the start of the ordinary radiation domination. So there's some region in here which is not very well understood. It's reheating. So the so this whole region here is sort of murky. It's not well understood. What's supposed to happen is slow roll inflation has to end at some point. So your inflaton field, there's some potential V of phi for the inflaton field. There's some phase of inflation, which is slow roll, but eventually the inflation has to end. So even though it's rolling slowly, it eventually maybe falls off this cliff in the potential and sort of comes down to a much lower value, so that inflation ends, and the field energy of the inflaton gets dumped into the energy of all the standard model particles. All the standard model particles are created essentially out of the energy that's stored in this inflaton field, and then you sort of transition into the radiation dominated universe that transition you could call the Big Bang. But the physics of this is not, I mean, it's not well understood because inflation itself is not well understood. It's nobody, you don't know what this potential is. There's a lot of leeway for what could have happened. But the idea is that it doesn't really matter. So this curve during inflation was increasing. It's coming down again after inflation. So whatever is happening, you know, it has to just connect and turn over like this. So the idea is that we have some mode K. It starts well inside the horizon during inflation, generated quantum mechanically. It wiggles along, and then it exits the horizon, fixed at some value. And we can calculate what that value is given a theory of inflation. And then it's frozen because it's outside the horizon and it can't move. So no matter what's happening with the physics inside the reheating, we don't need to know about it. It doesn't matter because this mode is frozen anyway. It's being conserved outside the horizon. And then eventually, after all this is done and we enter the radiation-dominated phase, it re-enters the horizon with the same value that we calculated it having left from inflation. So the idea is that we can trust the calculation that we get from inflation for this mode because of this property of being conserved outside the horizon the whole time that this unknown stuff is going on. So there's a theorem due to Weinberg where he shows that no matter what the components of the universe are, when we did it here, we only had one component. We had this one scalar field. And we saw that it's conserved outside the horizon because it's a very damped harmonic oscillator. In other words, a solution to the scalar field equation, if we write again the scalar field equation plus as k goes to zero, there exists a solution where phi dot is zero. There's a constant solution. So that's the statement that the mode is conserved outside the horizon. In this extreme limit where the wavelength is very small compared to the damping, the solution is just that phi is constant. So that's what's called an adiabatic mode. So there's this theorem due to Weinberg that no matter how many components you have in the universe, all the matter, dark matter, radiation, whatever you have, there will always be one mode with this property, one mode whose solution is constant outside the horizon. And that's what's known as the adiabatic mode. And often during inflation, like when we do the calculation during inflation, we won't have to do any work to find this mode because there will only be one scalar mode. So if there's only one scalar mode, as the case for our toy example here, then by this theorem, you know that mode is the one that's conserved outside the horizon. And you can make this argument that whatever value you calculate from inflation after having left the horizon is the value that you get after you re-enter the horizon. Okay, so next week we'll start again with how to do the quantum mechanical calculation to predict what the amplitude of this mode is supposed to be if it's really generated by quantum fluctuations. So that will involve essentially quantizing this theory. So that's quantum field theory on curved space and all the associated stuff that goes along with that, which will give us a quantum mechanical prediction for the initial density perturbations, which can then be argued to carry over to the initial conditions here. And then once you know the initial conditions here, you have to evolve the fluctuations until the point where they hit the recombination and imprint on the CMB. So you know these initial values from inflation, but you still have to evolve, do some time evolution to exactly figure out these wiggles. So those wiggles are calculated, you have to essentially solve the full Boltzmann equation for the plasma that's here in order to get a very accurate calculation of those wiggles. So on the final day, I'll show you, or maybe someone else will demonstrate one of these Boltzmann codes. So think CMB fast or CAM. There are these codes you have to use to essentially numerically solve the entire Boltzmann equation to get accurate wiggles to fit to the actual CMB. So you use these codes to solve for the wiggles to get the value for when it hits and imprints on the CMB. And then after that, the photons essentially free stream until they get to us at our current point in time. And that there's also effects associated with the free streaming. The photons have to pass through potentials. They pass through ionized gas. And these things have to be accounted for to get the kind of accuracy to compare to the actual CMB sky. OK, so I think this is a good stopping point, and we'll pick up with the quantization of this next week. Any questions?